you all. K2RIW. Signing in a little bit late. At this time, we begin the check out. K2RYY and N2EO. We've already got signed in. TechNet stuff meets every Sunday night for 4 hours usually, where the curious radio amateurs gather and teach each other more about wireless equipment. And as you guys know, the first section is where we take check-ins at the, in the order in which people check in, because they do have a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. Second section of the TechNet is Dr. Roy, AC2GS, with the science talk, and also the mailbag. Third section is Paul, WS2N, with the space report. And my printer's not working, so I can't make a copy of the emails they mail me where the subjects are going to be discussed. We're going to take check-ins right now. So we've got Joe and Rich. Anyone else to sign in, because you do have a question or comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Is there no one else to check into the TechNet tonight other than Joe and Rich? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W2OSR, I'm out here listening, Dick.
Okay. Do you want your call letters and name to be on the list, Bob? Because you do have a question or a comment. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Not tonight, thank you.
Okay, one last call. Anyone else want to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
VPN.
A very noisy VPN. And when we come to you, are you going to be there or are you going to be going as usual? Mr. VPN, K2RIW.
Waiting for the call.
Okay, I got to give you a warning. Your signal is 50% noise, 50% signal. You're very noisy and very weak from wherever you are. So, Joe, go ahead with your first question. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Good evening, Dick. How are you? W2RYY here. Last week you were talking about antenna gains with dishes, and you mentioned a part of a formula. One part I guess I didn't replay it from last week, but it was 70 divided by the wavelength gives you the degrees of what a dish can be as far as beam width. Was that in wavelength? Was that in meters, parts of meters, or inches? That's the part I guess maybe I missed. So I'll elaborate on that again. Because it's interesting, you take the other part of the formula, and you take, say, like a dish that's 10 degrees by 10 degrees, and that gives you a theoretical gain of, 24 or something like that, and change. And if you change those numbers by a factor of 10, each number, and go down to, say, 1 degree, your gain now goes up 20 decibels. Back to you, Dick, on the first part of the question.
Yes, a good rough rule of thumb as to what beam width you're going to get out of a horn, dish, or whatever. Anything that has an aperture to it where you can define the width of the aperture, the width of the horn, the width of the dish, and so on. And even if it's an open-ended piece of waveguide, the width of the piece of waveguide. If you take the number of wavelengths, I didn't say the wavelength, the number of wavelengths that is that dimension, and divide it into 70, it gives you a good approximation as to the beam width in that direction. If your wavelength happened to be 1 inch, because you're on 10 gigahertz, and if the aperture you're talking about happens to be 7 inches wide. That's 7 wavelengths. 7 wavelengths into 70 would give you a predicted beam width of 10 degrees. So it isn't wavelength in inches or meters or whatever. It's the number of wavelengths of the width of the aperture in that dimension. If it's the horizontal beam width you care about, it's the horizontal dimension of the horn. How many wavelengths wide is it? Divide the number of wavelengths wide into 70 degrees, and it'll give you a good prediction as to the beam width you're going to get in that dimension on the horn. Does it make a little bit more sense on the first half so far, Joe? W2LYY, C2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the number of wavelengths across the diameter of the dish. Yes, I guess it's starting to make more sense. You have to convert one or the other into the same unit of measurement, so you get the right answer. I guess if your dish was 3 meters wide, you're playing with something that's a half of a couple of inches across or a couple of centimeters across. I seem to follow you now. Okay. Yeah, good, very good. As I said, it's an interesting formula to play around with mathematically, and if you go, like, as I said, from a dish, and I'm sure you got the people who with NASA who designed these huge dishes that can go down to probably something of maybe tenths of a wavelength in degrees as far as beam width, horizontally and vertically. But it's interesting how that follows a formula. The formula follows a something very definable. You go ten times 10, dropping it, your decimal goes a point. So if you went from 10 degrees beam width down to 0.1 degrees beam width, you go up by a factor of 40 decibels. This is, I guess, in relation to the question that was like 2 weeks ago about what 60 Minutes is doing about this microwave interference. But it's fascinating to think about that. Now, also, can you design a dish, or could it be designed? My TOC got me. Could someone design a dish mechanically to have a very, I guess they could design a dish to mechanically have a very, very tight beam width, but electronically put something else in there, be able to steer that beam and be able to say somewhat pencil, like a pencil point, and electronically steer that beam where you could put, you could cover like the entire face of a building.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, when it comes to a dish like, say, for instance, the 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, NASA, Deep Space Dish number 14, as they call it, and when they're on X-band, 240 feet is something like 2,000 wavelengths on 10 gigs. 8.5 gigs, they get 1/10 or 0.05 degrees of beam width out of that antenna. And now you're asking, can you electronically steer that? The answer is sort of yes. You can steer a dish by moving the dish in azimuth or elevation mechanically. You can steer the beam up to at least 10 beam widths by moving the feed horn. Or moving the phase center of the feed horn. The feed horn could be a phased array, and you could decide which elements of the phased array are going to be turned on at that particular position. So you could do some electronic steering by steering where the signal is coming from. You have a cluster feed of horns, so to speak, at the focal point of the dish. That's one way of doing it. Or if it's a great big flat phased array, there's all kinds of ways you can use a beam-forming network and steer the beam coming out of that. And by the way, you keep saying dish when it comes to a diameter. That formula, the number of wavelengths divided into 70 degrees, works for horns, dishes, phased arrays, whatever. As long as you know the aperture width of the antenna. It doesn't have to be a dish, it could be a horn. Number of wavelengths in that dimension gives you a good approximation. You're about to ask where the 70 degree comes from.
Repeater, timeout.
It would be, trying to think of the name, what they call the damn thing. The 58 degrees. 1 over 2 pi. Okay. If you had a perfectly uniform distribution, you would be dividing not into 70 degrees, but you're dividing into 58 degrees. All of a sudden, I can't remember where the 58 degrees comes from. Can't think of the name of the darn phenomenon. But because almost every horn has a certain aperture distribution, almost any way you feed a dish with a horn in front of the dish, you're feeding less energy at the perimeter than you are at the center. You get a broader beam width, and therefore the number 58 becomes 70. So 70 is a good approximation. So use the 70 radians. It's a 1 radian. The 58 in a fraction degrees is 1 radian. If there was completely uniform distribution across the aperture, you'd be dividing into 1 radian, 58 in a fraction degrees. But almost no antenna has uniform distribution of its power. Now, the other formula I gave you last week, let me drop it. Was if you take the horizontal beam width in degrees and the vertical beam width in degrees of a known antenna, multiply the two together, divide into the number 30,000. As a hard number, it gives you a good approximation as to what is the gain of that antenna. Take 10 times the log of that and you can convert it into decibels. You're absolutely right. Now, if you divide the horizontal beam width by 10 to 1 and divide the vertical beam width by 10 to 1, then yes, your antenna would be, let me think about that. I think the answer was 20 dB higher in gain. 100 to 1 higher in gain, yes. So, there is no limit. As long as you've got the right kind of surface accuracy, and accuracy in the way you're feeding your aperture, whether it be horn, phased array, dish, whatever, there is no limit. In theory, you could make an antenna 1,000 wavelengths wide, like a good radio telescope might be, and you could have an extremely narrow beam width out of that antenna, in which case you'd most likely want to have some electronic steering so that you can peek up on a signal that's out there. You may not be able to mechanically move the dish fast enough, accurately enough, in order to take a pencil beam that's a tenth of a degree wide. And when Goldstone is listening to the Voyager spacecraft out there at 12 billion miles away, they're getting these kind of beam widths. W2LYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I keep on using the word dish because that's what the mental picture always seems to be, is something like a parabolic dish, but I do understand that there's other structures that could be used and work similarly, but that's interesting also that if they can get that kind of gain, they must have some pretty fancy software to be able to steer that dish mechanically to be able to keep in a line on the target that's 13 billion miles away because the Earth rotates and other things happen. You know, you're physically moving, the Earth is physically moving, so it's got to be some pretty fancy software that can mechanically or electronically move that beam accordingly to keep you always on the target.
There's something called a monopulse radar system, where the way you pick up the signal at the feed horn, if you got the right kind of a feed horn, which is really multiple horns combined in a particular way, you can measure the angular error in azimuth and angular error in elevation of the signal you're listening to. And that dish has that. So the dish can electronically peak itself on the signal. It knows that the signal is a little bit to the left and a little bit higher, if you know what I mean, by using monopulse techniques. So there's fancy kinds of electronic steering, and there's fancy ways you can set up a feed horn that tells you what is your angular error in those two dimensions, azimuth and elevation, for instance, Joe. So when it comes to the Earth rotation, the Earth motion around the sun, and the location of Voyager, all of this is calculatable. You know ahead of time where you are on the Earth, how fast the Earth is rotating, and so on. So It's not a very elaborate computer program to crank out the prediction as to how fast the dish has to steer, so to speak, in order to compensate for Earth rotation. Over to you, Joe, KQLIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. I have no more questions as far as for this part of the night. I do have one for the physics part later on, and I'll keep that towards the end of it because I can't talk on the radio past 9:40 because I'm taping something off the air and it comes on at 9 o'clock, or well, actually 9:40. Unfortunately, basketball gets the way and it alters the time factor on how broadcast stuff is broadcast. So from 9:40 to 10:40, I have to have radio silence.
Okay, so I guess when we go over to the science talk, you'll have to ask your question pretty soon near the beginning in order to make sure we don't avoid your 9:40 to 10:40 window. Very large radio telescopes, like for instance the Arecibo, 1,000-foot diameter dish, I think it's 1,000-foot, can have a ridiculously high gain in decibels or extremely narrow beam width. You'd think there'd be a limit. As long as you've got the right surface accuracy in the way you're feeding it and the way you're steering it, there is no limit. The highest gain antenna in the world that I know of has a gain of 168 decibels. 168 decibels of gain. It has a beam width, I seem to remember, it's a few seconds of arc of beam width. Guess where that antenna is, Joe? It's a B2RYY, K2RYW, 168 dB of gain.
Oh, I don't know where it is. You know where it is, but unfortunately it's also not in your backyard.
I'm talking about the 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope. It happens to be operating in optical frequency, but you take 200 inches of diameter, you take a wavelength in the middle of the optical band, 500 nanometers, so to speak, 550 nanometers, and you use that formula, number of wavelengths divided into 70 degrees, or horizontal and vertical beam width calculation divided into 30,000 and so on. As an antenna, although it's operating at an optical frequency, the 200-inch Mount Palomar has got 168 dB of gain, and I forget what the beam width is. I think it's something like 0.05 seconds of arc. And that's an antenna. I mean, the radio spectrum, you know, starts off at, let me pick a number, 60 kilohertz is a very low-frequency radio. And that spectrum, no frequency is high enough. As you go higher and higher and you go into the optical frequencies, go through the high frequency millimeter wave, sub-millimeter wave, far infrared, near infrared, optical, it's all the exact same radio spectrum. That's one hell of an antenna. Over to you, Joe, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. You mentioned that a couple of times, but no frequency is high enough. Is it not high enough because, well, let me put it in a different way. Past the frequency band of light, you have ultraviolet, I guess it's the top end, ultraviolet, then it goes into what? The first one is X-rays, is it cosmic rays, and then gamma rays, as far as going up the spectrum in higher and higher frequency. And how do you know, or how do you really know that there isn't actually energy beyond either cosmic rays or X-rays as far as the wavelength is concerned? How do you really know that? Has it been proven?
Yes, I think so. When it comes to some of these super bursts that we're getting from space, an awful lot of the super high frequency stuff doesn't penetrate our atmosphere, so you have to have a spacecraft out there to sense it. No matter what they've put out there, no matter what frequency it operates at, they've never found a limit beyond which, hey, we've gone too high in frequency, there's nothing propagating out there anymore. They've never discovered that. And no matter what kind of detector you put above our atmosphere, eventually Mother Nature will supply some kind of a burst of energy, supernova, or whatever, that's going to, for some number of microseconds, it's going to saturate your detector. There's some pretty powerful things going on out there periodically. So you're sort of asking, does the electromagnetic spectrum run out of steam? I think you can almost say the answer is no. If you've got the right kind of equipment, you can always go to higher and higher frequencies. The statement, no frequency is high enough, is a statement that Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, often puts on the end of his emails. He runs the microwave reflector up there in Massachusetts, WA1MBA. He's the guy who holds the distance record on 120 gigahertz. And as I said, he often says no frequency is high enough or no frequency is too high. Any further questions or comments? Over to you, Joe. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W, and Tuck Nat.
NYC2GS.
No other comments except this. All you people that play with microwave frequencies of very, very high nature, I think you should say anything like 1 gig or below DC.
Yeah, to the serious microwave ham radio operators, the people below 1 gigahertz are DC banders. So we've got Lou, NY2H, and also Roy in that order. NY2H, go ahead, Lou.
Does the speed of light place a limitation on a potential top-end frequency? I mean, in order for something to oscillate, it's going, say, two states, it's got to do that at some finite speed. So is there a limitation placed on it in nature by the speed of light?
The speed of light divided by the frequency you're using tells you what wavelength you've got. In the case of the optical frequency your eye is operating at right now, 550 nanometers, your eye, as an antenna, has a gain of 68 dBs. It has a 60th of a degree of beamwidth. Your eye can resolve a 60th of a degree of horizontal and vertical beamwidth. So you've got 68 dB of gain. You've got a pair of those antennas on the left side and the right side of your face. And something with a 60th of a degree of beamwidth, it's a how in the world are you going to properly aim that? You can focus your eye on a dot on the wall, so to speak, and you could wave your head back and forth and keep your eye tracking on that dot. That servo mechanism in your head has no trouble controlling a 60th of a degree of beamwidth antenna, and moving those muscles on your eye can do a beautiful job of tracking. That's one hell of a servo mechanism. But is there a limit as to how short a wavelength? I don't think there is. Over to you on that one, Bob. I mean, Lou. Over to you, Lou. K2LIW.
NY2H. Well, is there a physical limit on matter? I mean, is that Planck's constant or something like that? Let's get into play. And would not apply to a wavelength. So if you had a limit on the smallest wavelength, you'd have a limit on, I guess, the highest frequency.
As you go up to these super high frequencies beyond X-band, you start getting into something called the quantum effect. And I think Roy is going to clear this up for us right now. AC2, GS, K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, Beck. Dick, Lou, and Joe, there's a lot to cover, actually. Electromagnetic waves. Really, there is no frequency range inherently in X-rays versus gamma rays. On Earth, gamma rays are the consequence of electromagnetic energy generated from radioactive decay, and X-rays are the electromagnetic energy that's emitted when you excite electrons to higher energy levels. because of astronomy, you can't really for sure know what the source of the electromagnetic energy is. They arbitrarily made a rule that below a certain point, it's gamma rays. Below a certain point, it's X-rays. Above that point, it's gamma rays. By the way, cosmic rays per se are not rays. They're not electromagnetic. They're actually high-energy particles. They're very rapidly moving electrons, protons, helium nuclei and such. So cosmic rays aren't really rays. Sometimes they get bundled together with gamma rays. So that's that part. Let me drop for a sec.
True.
Okay, as Lou was saying, there is some question whether you can have a wavelength that's too short. There is something called the Planck's length. It's not the same as the Planck's constant. It's the theoretical smallest dimension that quantum mechanics will allow. If you have a wavelength that's shorter than a Planck's length, which means it can't exist, then you have a lot of problems trying to theorize that type of electromagnetic wave. Long before that, you develop a nonlinearity to electromagnetic waves because the energy content is so great that they can decay into particle-antiparticle pairs. And so the amount of them surviving from such episodes diminishes exponentially.
So there could very well be a limit as to how high a frequency you can go. But with the instrumentation that mankind has created up till now, oscillators and signal sources and generators and whatever, I don't think we come anywhere near the Planck length. As a frequency, the Planck length is probably what? 10 to the 20 power hertz, Roy, something like that?
I think it's something ridiculous like 10 to the minus 35 meters. It's a length measurement.
That's if you think of it as a wavelength, but if you think of it as a frequency. The optical frequencies you and I use right now with our eyes are... Is it 150 terahertz? 10 to the 15 hertz. I think optical frequencies are around 10 to the 15 hertz. And by the time you're getting up to X-rays and gamma rays, I think we're up to numbers like 10 to the 20 hertz. Isn't that true?
I would agree. But by when you get to the Planck numbers, which are unattainable and will be for maybe thousands of technological years, you're also worried about things like at a high enough energy content, if you're able to pack the energy equivalent of a black hole into a photon, it'll just kind of evolve into a black hole as well. So these are really woolly parameters. We're reaching the really theoretical absolutes of quantum mechanics where strange, strange things happen.
We've got a long way to go before we can get there. When it comes to laser generators and other things that we know of, what's the highest frequency or the shortest wavelength that we know of currently available generators that you happen to know, Roy? Go ahead.
I would assume that the highest it goes is infrared. Lasers really haven't been designed, to my knowledge, in the X-ray or gamma ray range, which is probably the next great frontier. Again, depending upon how you want to define what a gamma or an X-ray is. If it's created by an electrical excitation, then it's purely an X-ray. If it's powered by a decay mechanism, it would be a gamma ray laser. But I'm not aware of any X-ray or gamma ray lasers, but I could have missed up on that.
You were saying that lasers don't go beyond infrared. When it comes to the direct frequency, the basic frequency, the fundamental, maybe so. There are blue lasers, but maybe they're operating on the second or third harmonic of the basic oscillator. Over to you on that one, Roy.
No, I'm sorry, I misspoke, Dick. Ultraviolet. It goes all the way up into ultraviolet range, but not really beyond the ultraviolet, to my understanding.
Sounds right. So, I don't think we've run into any of these theoretical limitations yet. I guess it was Lou that was asking this question. The way the spectrum seems to be continuous, you can go as low as you want. In theory, you can make a radio wave at 1 hertz or 1 kilohertz and radiate it in space and detect it at some distance. So there seems to be no limit on the low end, and there's almost no limit on the high end. Or at least we've got a long way to go before we're going to be running into any of these limits. What made you think there would be a limit, Lou? NY2H, K2LIW.
NY2H. Well, I thought that there would be because of the speed of light is where I started that whole thought process.
Just take an optical frequency, 550 nanometers, 10 to the 15 hertz, and figure out how many wavelengths you've got in the first mile that optical frequency spreads goes through. They come up with huge numbers. And the light coming from a star, 13 billion light years away, at those optical frequencies, gets to us. Obvious by that picture on the ultra deep field done by Hubble. So, now there seems to be almost no limit. Okay, the next person on the list was Rich in 2EO. Go right ahead, Rich. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. N2EO, what I'm going to say is much simpler than what you guys were just talking about. More of a problem with the Baron. Well, I got the new one. It's made by Baron Designs. It works perfectly, even with a kilowatt. Hank, N1YDY stopped by here today. Very kind of him to install the new Baron, because me being in a wheelchair. No, I can't reach the wall. So he put it up. I gave him the old one, which is a brand new power star. I thought it said 1,500 watts. He called me up on the telephone and said they had the nerve to call it a 4,000 watt Baron when it could barely handle 500 or 600 watts.
N1YDY, Hank, go right ahead. In other words, you came to the conclusion that his older Baron could barely handle 400 or 500 watts. I wonder how you came to that conclusion, Hank. What kind of a test were you running? Go ahead. And when it got hot, into a dummy load, so to speak?
He actually did the work of testing, and it was when it got hot while he was transmitting. I just wanted to give you a physical comparison between these two units.
Go right ahead. Tell us everything you've got, Hank. Go right ahead.
So the one we took down was made by Palstar in the U.S., and the other one was made by a company called Ballon Design. Both these boxes were approximately the same size. They had, they were 4-to-1 with a cable, coax SO239 on one side, and a set of insulated posts with wing nuts on the other. The Palstar was rated at 4 kW, the Ballon Design at 3 kW. PALSTAR was in a large plastic box. When I took it off his wall, I noticed that it was a lot lighter than the one we were replacing it with physically. I didn't measure it, I'm sorry, but it was very obvious when you picked the two up, one right after the other. The PALSTAR also rattled. So when I got it home, I opened the box and discovered that the ballon consisted of two ferret type of toroids, you know, those tubular ones with the wires run in between them. They were mounted in a very thin plastic box, and these toroids occupied less than 50% of the physical space in the box. The box was not waterproof and had some rather thin wires, and in fact this particular unit actually had a cold solder joint, which was easy to determine with a VOM and to repair. Let me drop it. The one he replaced it with, the Ballon design, was approximately the same size. It was built into a waterproof electrical box, the type of junction box that you would buy at Home Depot for use outside. I got on the company's webpage. I saw that it was rated for 3 kW rather than 4, and they had pictures of the insides. And they had a rather massive toroid, circular toroid, in the inside in their pictures that occupied, I would say, 3/4 or maybe 80% of the available volume. And it had what appeared to be a better construction technique. And by that, let me give you a quick example. The PALSTAR was held together with, or held into the box, I should say, with double-sided tape, which had failed, and so the ballon was floating around loose, which is perhaps what caused the cold solder joint to fail. And the ballon design was suspended with two tie wraps that had anchors that were through-bolted to the case. Essentially, these products were within $10 of each other, and it really looked like they were a night and day difference between one and the other. So I wish him a lot of luck. His ballon no longer gets hot, and his SWR doesn't change with an 800-watt load, and so he seems to be in better shape than he was before. And one YDY back to Dick.
So it sounds like the PALSTAR was much flakier in design. A lot less ferrite, finer wires, not built quite as well, and it looks like they were extremely optimistic in their power ratings, and so the non-linearities at high power where Rich was running into change in Viswar, some kind of a saturation-like phenomena of his PALSTAR probably was taking place. That seems to be what we believe from the evidence he gave us, and you seem to be confirming it with the observations you've made. Over to you, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW.
Agree with everything you've said. The only other comment I would like to add is that it really seemed when I disassembled the PALSTAR that it was intentionally built in the case that it was in to make it appear to be bigger. I kind of thought, Rich used the word earlier in the day, and I think he's right, I kind of thought it was a fraud. It had that feel that you get when you disassemble something that you buy from Alibaba or some other questionable source. I was really surprised to see that it was made in the U.S. and made by PALSTAR or marketed by PALSTAR. Certainly it was a completely different product than the one he replaced it with from Ballon Design.
What does PALSTAR claim is the power rating of that particular Ballon, Hank, go ahead.
Their website says that it's 4 kW. One other item, by the way, for physical comparison was that I told you that the PALSTAR was not a waterproof case, but the Ballon Design was. And not only is the Ballon Design a waterproof case, but it has a custom manufactured neoprene seal that actually helped maintain that. So not a standard electrical box seal, but something that the manufacturer does. I'm not sure if it's manufactured or if it perhaps is a liquid, you know, a liquid type of caulk sealant, but it's apparently neoprene according to their website.
Now, Hank, it sounds like you wired in the Ballon Designs into Rich's antenna, and sounds like you guys fired it up. And what band did you put it on? What power did you put through it? And did you see evidence that the standing wave ratio was a favorable number that didn't change as a function of power? Over to you, Hank, K2IW.
Okay, I actually have to turn that over to Rich, only because I wasn't in a position to observe how he was testing it. His wheelchair occupies the space by his station. I will tell you that the SWR didn't change during the test that I observed while I was there. That was the big thing for him. But I can't tell you what band he was on. He did tell me he was running 800 watts.
And the Ballon Designs seems to be running quite cool. Ballon Designs claim they're good for, I think you said, 3 kilowatts.
It's on their website. So 4 kW supposedly for the Palstar and 3 kW for the Ballon Design, even though the Ballon Design appeared to me to be a much more robust physical device.
Sounds like Palstar is way off here on something. Maybe it's good for those kilowatts on 10 meters, but certainly not on 20 or 40. Your Ballon is going to come closer to saturating as you run high power at lower frequencies. So from your description, I wonder, from your knowledge, does Palstar claim a various power level at various frequencies, or do they just make a bold statement, 4 kilowatts, and the implication is that all frequencies, 160 meters through 10 meters. Over to you, Hank, K2IW.
The website does not differentiate which frequency. They simply claim it's a 4 kW device.
And what do they claim is the lowest frequency it's good for, Hank?
You know what, I don't have the website up. It was in the 160 meter band, but I can't recall exactly what the number was.
The evidence you've given us sounds like they're crazy. You put that kind of power at 160 to a piece of ferrite that's that small. Wow, is that going to saturate? And you're going to get smoke and flames, which is what Rich was getting. So, during your test today, Rich, I'm going to guess you were on either 40 or 20 meters. Sounds like you went to 800 watts. It sounds like everything was hunky-dory. N2EO, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yes. I like 40 meters. That's my favorite band. So I tested it there. I was getting 800 watts out continuous. I had to keep down for a long, long time. There was no sign of SWR rising, nothing. That's all I can say. I want to thank Hank from the bottom of my heart for coming here. He asked me the other day if he'd like me to come here, and I said absolutely yes. So I gave him the Palstar. Hank told me he's got an SB200. It'll handle that. That's a Heath kit with a pair of 572Bs. It runs about 500 watts. so he should be happy up to that point. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, Hank, what's the way that we can find out what power level you can really get to before you run into trouble with the PowerStar? I think you said you ran those experiments into a dummy load at your QTH. Over to you, Hank, KQRIW.
Negative, Dick. It was into Rich's system at his QTH. But I just have this thing sitting here. If you want to test it and let the net know what it does at some future date, you're more than welcome to use it.
I'm not equipped to do that. My HF rig, my SB, is it SB200? I've got a heat kit, the afterburner, but I haven't turned it on in 10 years. Guarantee it's electrolytic capacitors are in bad shape. So I'm not equipped. Thank you for the offer. Okay. Sounds like you're in good shape now, Rich. You've used it on 40 meters. You'll probably do some testing on 20 meters in the coming weeks. And we've been suspicious for some time that ballon was running into some kind of a saturation characteristic. We were hearing some funny stories from various people not recommending using the PowerStar. And it looks like Backlines has done a much better job of a good design of a robust ballon. And the ballon designs, how low does it go? Is it rated down to 160 meters? And how many watts do you believe it's rated for, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Well, the gentleman at Ballon Designs asked me how much power do I plan to run. That's a very good question he asked me. I told him I have a pair of 3500 and a Henley 2K. I'll run no more than about 1500 watts. Here's what he told me. It does not go to 160. But my amplifier doesn't go to 160. For more money, Sony Echo goes to 160. I would suggest that anybody who's looking for a ballon or a 9-to-1 onion, other stuff, has all those things. I asked him. How he got into making. It's a very small company. He's located in Texas. And he said to me, he didn't like any of the ones on the market. So he made his own, and then friends started asking for them. That's how he got into business.
Is your ballon designs rated down to 80 meters, or is it rated only down to 40 meters? Over to you, Rich. I think you said 80 meters through 10 meters. And it's rated for, 1,500 watts throughout the whole frequency region? Go ahead.
That's correct, Dick.
Okay. So, what's your guess? He's been in business how long from Texas? It sounds like he's making an awful nice product. Over to you, Rich.
I don't know how long he's been in business. See, the way I found him, this Cobra Compact Antenna listed him as a good source of balance. They know each other. The guy from Ballon Designs told me he's using Fry from Putnam, New York.
And I think Cobra was specifically not recommending the PowerStar. about, or was there an article somewhere saying that don't use the PAL star with the Cobra? Over to you, Rich.
Wasn't word of mouth. The way I found it, if you look in the ad for the Cobra compact antenna, in that ad, he recommends on the website to use the Baron from Baron Designs.
But I thought we heard in previous weeks that somewhere, somebody, either word of mouth or in writing, specifically said that Cobra does not recommend the Baron Design, the PALSTAR. Isn't that true, Rich?
AC2GS?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, Dick. Story, Andy, WA2CDL, was talking to the manufacturer in Nearfest and mentioning Richie's problem. And I think that's where it came to light that he didn't recommend PALSTAR per se. He had actually branded the Baron Design and sold it along with Baron Design, but you could buy it either way. But that's where we first heard that the PALSTAR was probably not a good choice.
Memory's starting to come back. I remember now. Previous weeks. Okay, sounds like that problem is essentially solved. Now, one last quick scan here. Anyone else with any questions or comments for the technical net on the question and answer section before we go over to the science talk? Give me a call. There's a name right now. KTRIW the tech net.
Dick, I just want to say again, I thank NYYDY, Hank, for all his wonderful help.
Sounds good, Rich. So anyone else with any question or comment, give me a call with his name right now.
Hank, N1YDY, and I do have what I hope is a quick question.
Go right ahead, Hank. And we haven't heard from you some time. Doesn't have to be quick. Take your time.
The theory that the higher the antenna, the better, I'm going to put a disc cone up in the attic. It's the highest place I can get something, and it allows me to have the feed point at the highest point that I can physically get it. And my question is, should I be running some type of a choke or a balun at the feed point or at the closest point to the feed point to prevent stray RF from running down the coax?
If you want to use belt and suspenders conservativeness, the answer is yes. Each individual antenna has its own characteristic as to how unbalanced it is and how much it is capable of launching a signal onto the outside of the coax cable. Each antenna has that characteristic. Sometimes by looking at the design, it's predictable ahead of time. Obviously, it can be measured. So to put even a poor man's balun, you know, a few turns of the coax taped together, belt and suspenders, it costs very little in insertion loss, dollars, out of material, and does give you some peace of mind. So go ahead and do it. Now, the higher the better, particularly when it comes to an antenna that has horizontal polarization. With vertical polarization, sometimes you can get away with some rather low altitudes and still get some very good performance. The way vertical reflects off the ground, the way horizontal polarization reflects off the ground near the antenna are quite different. The disc cone covers a very wide frequency region, and how much signal it launches onto the coax probably changes quite a bit as a function of frequency. Over to you, Hank, KTRIW.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of Smith charts that were prepared at various frequencies for the antenna. And, you know, I just am not an expert on this type of activity, so I was curious. And I'm kind of wondering if I do the Balin or do an air choke, which is what I was thinking, I will probably end up having to do a UHF to UHF coupling. In other words, two PL-59s into a double barrel SL-239. And, of course, anytime you have couplings, you have losses. So I'm just sort of trying to figure out which way I'm going to go. And now that you tell me that the vertical polarization is much less critical than the horizontal polarization, I believe that the rest of the exercise will become academic, because if it's not that critical, well, I've already got the antenna, I'll put it up. But perhaps I wouldn't have bought it if I'd known that to start with.
Is that something, Hank, that I'm going to contest? You said each of the couplings have losses. Everyone believes each UHF connector, for instance, has half a dB of loss. And there are people who will take an amplifier, like a Mirage, that has UHF connectors on it, and switch them over to type N connectors, and they think they're lowering the loss. I personally took a female-to-female UHF balance, a female-to-female UHF coupling with a pair of UHF PL-259 connectors into it, and I ran 700 watts through that, key down continuously at 432 megacycles, a parallel kilowatt amplifier, for 10 solid minutes. That connector, a medium quality PL-259, pairs them into that female double thing. At the end of the 10 minutes of key down, it got mildly warm to the touch. Mildly warm to the touch could be defined as 1 or 2 watts of dissipation. 1 or 2 watts out of 700 watts flowing through it at 432. That's a calculated insertion loss of 0.02 dB or something like that. Everyone believes every connector has loss. Absolutely, positively not true. Let me drop. You'd have to make the connector out of carbon granules to get the kind of losses that people are talking about. Coaxial cable has loss because of its length. When you're going through 100 feet of RG8 cable, for instance, you're going through an awful long length of copper on the semiconductor, copper on the outer conductor, and you're lighting up a hell of a lot of polyethylene when it comes to the dielectric. And all these things have loss. So, loss in dBs per foot is a relatively low number, but when you got 100 feet of it, it starts adding up. That connector, if it's made out of reasonable materials, and the connector is, what, half inch, three quarters of an inch long? If it had to look good, not be tarnished, pass an ohmmeter test, and it's three quarters of an inch long, for it to have half a dB of loss, which at a kilowatt, half a dB of loss is something like 50 watts, it would glow red hot and melt if it really had half a dB of loss. So, everybody believes connectors have loss. When you go and actually measure it, you're actually very pleasantly surprised. Over to you on that one, Hank. N1YDY, K2LIW.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. W2VL repeater system.
Didn't really realize, because I never thought it through, that you would have to have such a, you know, 50-watt dissipation in each coupling, and then, of course, that would glow hot and melt. So, you know, my soldering iron only has 15 to, or 20, depending upon which iron I use. So I understand exactly what you're trying to say. I simply hadn't thought about it. Great information. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, every ham on 20 meters is telling each other that don't use connectors. Run your coax cable straight up to the antenna with no interfacing devices of any kind, because all connectors have loss. Everyone believes that. We've been hearing it for so many years that it has become a kind of a truth. It's a phony truth, fake news. If you think about it, to try to make it have that much loss and yet pass an ohmmeter test, That's crazy. Even the cheaply made ones. I guess if you had some really ratty Bakelite-like insulator in there, which is soaked in salt water, I guess you could make it kind of lossy, but it would be difficult. And you would...